Hi, my name is Linda, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Billy for asking me to come. That was very kind, and it's always a privilege to be able to share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll try to speak slowly, which is something that's really tough for me. And I'm a damn Yankee, so there may be a language barrier. My husband and I had one when we first started dating. It was terrible. We would say to each other, spell that. It was awful. Anyway, let's see. It says in the book, in a general way, what our life was like, what happened, and what we're like now. So I'm going to start at 25. I was 25 years old. I already had one drunk driving under my belt. I had it somewhere between 21 and 24. I couldn't tell you what year it was. I was in a blackout in my first drunk driving. 25, I turned 25 in March. Somewhere in between the end of March, I accrued my second drunk driving in Massachusetts. And that was pretty awful. So in Massachusetts at the time, that was in 1987. You had to go to drunk school for 2 weeks. They incarcerated you at a treatment facility run by the state. And lots of things happened. So come August of that year, so I get arrested in March. I'm looking at going away for 2 weeks. Got probation. Drink all the time. I'm a barroom drinker. I love to drink in barrooms. I hadn't done the morning drink yet. I still was employable. You know, life was starting to get, in my mind, unmanageable. Maybe it was before then, but around 25, things were starting to take off for me. Come August is my best friend's wedding, my best childhood friend's wedding. She gets married on a Saturday. I'm supposed to show up at drunk school sober and on Sunday. I go to my best friend's wedding. Of course, I have no money to buy the dress. You know, she pays for me to be in her wedding because I'm always drinking. I'm living on my own, and I'm making decent money, but I don't have two dimes. I pay the rent, and I pay for my career in drinking or whatever, drinking and things. So I go to her wedding, and of course I know I'm not going to be sober the next day, and that means it's the possibility of incarceration. You throw up drunk, you can get incarcerated. You're supposed to be incarcerated. I go there. First of all, I go to the wedding, I cause a huge scene, I'm drunk, I'm drinking, it's 4 a.m. I guess I passed out, according to her, and they had this redone garage in the garage floor. That's really ladylike. Her husband picks me up, puts me in his bed, they go off to the airport, she makes sure somebody gets me to drunk school from Fairhaven to the Cape. They wake me up, and it was a nightmare, it was ugly. I get down there with my bag, they drop me off, I walk in, and, you know, it's seeping out of every pore. It's coming out of my mouth. They give me this litmus paper test or something. It's off the charts, and they say, you need to leave. So I'm like, all right. So off I go. I take my little bag, and I stick my thumb out. I thumb home 25 miles, and my mother's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, they wouldn't take me. I was drunk. And so now I'm looking at possible incarceration, got to go see the PO, and you know, I'm thinking, oh, well, although really, I don't want to go to jail because I'm not that kind of girl. I don't know how I would have survived that, and luckily, God was on my side. I go see the PO, he cuts this good deal, and then I have to go in September. So when September comes around, I go to drunk school for 2 weeks. That's my first loss of my freedom, you know, my second skirmish with the law. Again, I was in a blackout. I've been in jail twice. Don't remember either time. I was in blackouts. The first one I had, a friend of mine come get me because I had bail money, but they wouldn't let me go. The second one, I don't even remember how I got out of there. So I show up at a drunk school, and it was pretty informative. You know, they gave me these little tests. They didn't ask me to read, you know, to pass them in, and I was pretty honest. They would say, you know, has this, or this happened? And I'd go, never. And so they were saying, you know, according to my little test, I was middle stages alcoholism. I don't know how you got that, but that's what they said. And what I thought was, I saw these things and I listened. One thing I have to say is I listen. I may look like I'm not listening to you. I may say very unkind things and unpolite, you know, impolite things to you, but I hear everything you tell me. So I heard everything that went on in there, and I took all that information and said, not me, and walked out the door, but it heard it. It was in my head. I lasted 2 days without a drink, and I was absolutely off my rocker. I was restless. I was unbelievably discontent, and I'm like, oh, my God, drink, don't drink, drink. I had these voices running in my head, and I couldn't stand it after 2 days, and I picked up a drink. And what had happened is somewhere after between that and sometime in the in between September and December, I was off on a run, and I had this horrible, horrible event at my mother's house. And I was in a, you know, what they call a gray out. There were pieces of the night I remember and pieces of the night I don't remember. The most despicable part of the night, I happen to remember. And my mom got to witness me at my worst and in her home. And it was, to me, it was pretty ugly. And that was like the biggest thing on my fourth step that I just couldn't talk about. My biggest shame. And I was talking about stealing my father's truck, and I just was, it was just ugly. And I behaved very badly, and I was very embarrassed. And I don't remember how, I don't remember how I left the house. I don't remember who came and got me. I don't remember where I spent the night. But it, at that point, it caused me to move out of my mother's house again, and my dad. My mom and my dad. I always say my mom, but it's and my dad. I moved out of my parents' home again, and I was quite ashamed. And December of 1987 was New Year's. I love to travel. I love to drink when I travel. And when I travel, that's the only time I give myself permission to drink in the morning. And it was New Year's Eve, and I was on Fort Lauderdale Beach, and it was another big blowout. And I had been drinking since 10 a.m. It was midnight. I ran into a fella that I used to date who was just this nice man. He was a nice man. And I stopped dating him because he was a nice man. And I just figured that I was not a nice person. I was just going to just run right outside, and he was just a nice guy. And my M.O. was I didn't want to date anybody who wanted anything from me. You know, I did exactly what I wanted, when I wanted, where I wanted, with whoever I wanted, when the moment struck. And so I really didn't want a boyfriend, nor did I have a boyfriend, because I didn't want somebody telling me where I needed to be, or how I needed to act, or that I had to go to the family dinner, or I had to show up at the, you know, the office picnic. So he was just a nice man, and I liked him, and I was really drunk, and that's when the saying blind drunk comes to mind, because I couldn't see. I was so drunk, and I was at the Jolly Roger trying to play the jukebox, and he was like, Linda, and he had a funny name for me. His name is Terry. It was a boy's name, so I was like, I always thought it was funny. He's like, Linda, it's Terry, and I'm like, no way, and I couldn't focus to see him, and I kept saying, where did you go to school? Because I thought where he went to school was silly, and he said, I'm like, oh my God, it's you, and it was just, it was another horrible evening. It was a horrible evening. And he was flying out the next morning, and I remember he got up, and I was curled up in the bed, and I was sick, and feeling lousy, and I thought, like, that's the last picture this guy has of me. And I really liked him, and I was just, it wasn't pretty. And so he left, and he kept saying, he's like, I'm going to call, I'll call you when I get back into town. I'm like, yeah, right, like, I'd call me. And he never called, and I was pretty sick. And so I remember, you know, you wake up, you're dying of thirst, and I remember getting up, and I went up to the corner, and I drank, like, you know, 6 gallons of water, and then I felt like a washing machine. I was sick to my stomach, and all this water slushing, and I'm curled up in bed again, and I feel awful. And it was another one of those nights. So I fly home. It's now January 1988, and the guy I'd been dating for 7 years makes no demands on my life, and it's been 7 years of catch me when you can, and it was perfect. And he asked me what I was doing, and I said to him, you know, I just can't get out of this vacation mode. I don't know what's going on with me, Joey, but when I went out with Joey, Joey and I went out, it was days. And so it was the middle of the week, and Joe came and picked me up, and I know now from coming out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't stop drinking. You know, I just didn't want to put down the drink. I wasn't done. And that had never happened to me. So Joey came and picked me up, and that was a three-day vendor. And you see, my measuring stick for alcoholism was employability. I went to work. I had a very good job. I made very good money, and I had a very responsible job. And I could keep the two worlds separate, and I couldn't I couldn't keep the world separate anymore. You know, they were this world, my drinking, and I did other substances, were starting to interfere with each other. And so Joe leaves one day. I finally kick Joey out, and I'm like, you gotta go home, you gotta do something, you got the work truck, I'm sick, you gotta go. He drops the work truck off, comes back an hour later, he's at the door again. So it's 8 o'clock in the morning on a work day, and I'm like, I gotta go to work, but you know, if we're gonna drink, we're going to the bar, because that's where I like to drink. I don't like to drink at home, I don't like to drink in the backyard, I don't like to drink at barbecues, I want to drink, I do all my drinking in a bar room. 8 o'clock, we're at the bar, and I say to the barmaid, I'm going to leave at 10 to catch 10 o'clock bus to go to work. Because by now, I have no license, right? 25 loser, riding a bike, no license. riding my bike to work, getting on a bus because I work downtown Boston. I live 25 miles from where my job, and so of course I don't go to work. So I drink all day, and this is the most significant part of my story. And Joe is really drunk, according to me. No. Of course, Joey and I have been doing the same thing for days, right? But Joey's just really drunk. So Joey's sister has an apartment over the bar, and I'm like, Joey, you need to go home. You need to get a couple hours sleep. I'll come get you in an hour. An hour later, he calls the bar screaming at the bartender because I hadn't come and got him. And I went up to the and he had been sick everywhere. He had drank so much, he was sick. He was just sick everywhere. So put him to bed. I went back down to the bar. I continued doing what I was doing, and he came in an hour later. Door slams open, screaming because I didn't come get him, and he proceeds to drink. And I was like, "You just vomited! Like, how could you even conceive of drinking?" I just didn't get it. And I looked at him from across the bar. Now he was so mad. We were looking at each other from across the bar room. And I went in and I got up and I went into the restroom, and I was like that pasty white. Dark circles. I looked awful, and I went back to my bar stool, and, you know, I kind of lifted my head up, and I saw very separate people sitting on very separate bar stools leading very separate lives. And I was 25 years old, and that's not the life I wanted to live for me. I had dreams. I was the girl I had. I just wanted, you know, all I wanted was a family, a husband, kids, you know, 2.5 kids, two cars in the driveway, the white picket fence. That's all I have ever wanted. And, that wasn't happening for me, and I was not nice. And when I started, I was a completely different person. But by the time I finished drinking and drugging, I was just somebody that you couldn't recognize anymore. And I would go to bars that probably weren't very safe, but people felt the need to take care of me because they said, "You don't belong here, kid." And I'd be like, "No, I'm fine, I'm fine." And at the end, I belonged there. And in the beginning, I didn't belong there. And at the end, I belonged there just fine. And I could take care of myself just fine, unfortunately. And So I lifted my head up, I looked out, and I was drinking at an old man's bar, and I mean an old man's bar. I mean, there were like a lot of 70-year-old guys smoking cigarettes, drinking, been there, wives, been drinking there for 30 years. And I ran out the door, and as I was running out the door, this kid was coming in the door, and he took me home. And my brother had been sober for about 2 years at this point. He had done the 28-day rehab thing down at Edge Hill, very poshy-posh, nice, cushy-cushy place. Country short resort and a country club resort there, kind of detox, rehab, and he'd gotten sober and stayed sober. But he happened to be living in Florida at the time. And for me, I had always thought that I had had trouble with booze. After my second drunk driving, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous just to see. I was 25, and I went in, and it was a really dark hall, and it was a Wednesday night. I'll never forget it, and I cried. And they were so nice. And the more I cried, the nicer they were. And they gave me a bumper sticker, and I wanted to scream because I was so embarrassed. And they gave me a book, which made me feel worse. And I kept saying, "Yeah, I don't want anybody to know I've been here." And I just didn't think I belonged. I just wasn't ready. I didn't want to do what it was going to entail for me to do to get sober. And I just decided that from that, I wasn't an alcoholic because the remedy was far worse for me. So So Joey and I have this thing. I run out. I call my brother, and I say to my brother, "You know, you've got to do something for me. You got to get me help because the sun's going to rise, and I'm going to say it was a bad night, and I'm going to be okay, and I'm not going to want to drink. So can you please help me?" And he said, and he had a sponsor up where I lived in my hometown, and you know, we were fighting about it. I wanted to, you know, go to a 28 Poshy Posh resort, and my insurance company didn't want to do that, and so they didn't want to pay for anything, and so. At that time, my mother and father were in Europe. I was in Florida. I get home from Florida. They were still in Europe. So I decide that I'm going to go away. But now we got a problem with finances here. Who's going to pay for me to go? So my insurance company wasn't going to have it. So a couple things happened that were pretty instrumental. At that point in my life, it was January 7th. I had my own apartment. I lived across town, but my parents were in Europe. And when Joe and I were on our run, my mom has a full-stock bar. They have more liquor than a bar room. And we went there every night. After the bars closed, we went to my mother's house to drink all their liquor. And so that I was staying at my mom's house. And so I didn't really think anybody would be looking for me at my mom's house. And I hadn't gone to work, which is totally unlike me. And so the phone rang, and I figured wouldn't be anybody but somebody looking for my mom. And I heard Linda. And I can just feel what I felt. It was awful. My heart sank, and I started to cry. And he said, I think you owe me an explanation. And I said, I'm having a trouble with booze and drugs, and I'm leaving tomorrow to go get help. And it was my boss. And he was really nice. He was very kind. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I called my parents. I told them in Europe. And I said to my mother, I won't be home when you get home. And she's like, really? Because I had a habit of just, like, jumping in the car and leaving states. And she's like, where will you be when I get home? And I said, I'm going to get help. And Rick, my brother's help is setting it all up. And she said, and she's never done this. She said, talk to your father. And my dad said, can you wait till we get home on the 8th? Or that must have been the 6th or the 7th. He said, I'll be home on the 7th. Can you wait till we get home on the 7th? I want to talk to you. And I said, okay. So my boss, and I relayed that story to my boss. I said, I'm going to get help, and my parents are coming in tonight. They don't clear customs till 6, and I'm waiting for them to come home, and they're taking me away. So he said, what would you like to do? And I said, when I get back in the corner, I just get flip and fresh, and I said, I might as well just go on my stomach because I can't drink ever again. He's like, Linda. And I'm like, I'd like to come to work. Will you let me come to work for the day? And until my parents get home. He's like, yeah. So I jumped on the bus and I went to work. He sat me in his office and he said, if you get clean, you get sober and stay sober, I will keep your job. Now, I don't understand why. I was less than pleasant at my job. I was always, I stunk of booze most of the time, but I am a decent employee and I work hard. And he told me he'd keep my job. And my parents came home and my parents are just working class people, and I know this is God in my life today, and I wanted the 28-day program, and I wanted what I wanted, and my parents didn't have it. They don't have much money, and my parents paid for me to go to rehab, and they could only afford 17 days. They had to pay for a 3-day detox, which I didn't need, because I had no physical addiction to alcohol or drugs, but it was part of the protocol, and then they paid for a 14-day treatment program, and that's pretty risky business. It was all they had in their savings account. It was all they could afford. And they took what they had and they gave it to me. And it just kills me because money's hard to come by. And my father worked really, really hard. And it meant a lot. And so he pays for my rehab, and I feel terrible about it. And they take me to this place down the Cape called Gosnold. And before they take me for my last supper, my last meal. And it's like a restaurant somewhere, and of course there's bar, you know, it's a bar room, and I can remember this like it was yesterday. There were bottles all over the wall, and I'm looking at them, and they're, you know, all these pretty colors, and it's amber, and it's clear, and it's green for creme de menthe, and I'm thinking like, oh my God, what did I do? I had this terrible moment of panic. Like, what am I going to do? I don't want to do this. This is all a mistake, is what's going through my head. Oh, my God, oh, my God. And I am. I'm in a state of panic. And then it flips to I'm mad. Now I'm mad. And so they take me to this place, and it's called Gosnold, and it's down in Falmouth, Massachusetts, on the Cape. And they have a sign that says a bridge back. And I'm in the back seat, and I say in my head, really, snap, bridge back to what? And the person presses, what a stupid thing. I don't understand that. That is just, and they take me and they leave me, and it was awful. It was awful. And I go into this place, and the first 3 days were terrible because it was a weekend, and I didn't need to be detoxed, so I couldn't have been more bored out of my life. But anyway, then the first week when I was in treatment, they asked me to do things that totally contrary to the way I've been living my life. You know, they talked a lot about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know, people make fun of rehabs, but, I mean, we had a guy in our, that was one of the leaders, and he talked about getting on your knees and asking God to keep you away from a drink or a drug. And he dropped to his knees in front of us, and I was mortified. I was absolutely horrified. And I can remember saying to him, I'm like, you mean figuratively. You don't even really expect me to drop to my knees. And he's, I mean, you're just talking like in my mind, figuratively. I don't really have, he's like, no, Linda, literally. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't do that. I'm not even going to do that. And so there was all sorts of things going on, and I was playing the detox game, although I didn't know it then, but I was, and I was getting close to being thrown out, and
And they told me if I didn't turn things around. So two important things that happened there was that before that happened, I called my father. And he asked me how I was doing, and my dad loves me. My mother loves me. They love me. They love me. They just love me. And I said to my dad, this place is a terrible place. I said something else. I was cussing. I'm not supposed to cuss up here. I said, you have to come. Come here. It's terrible. It's awful. Oh, my God, it's terrible here. And my brother called as soon as I hung up the phone, and my dad was on his way to get me, and my brother said, leave her. She's right where she needs to be. Do not go get her. And he left me. He left me there. And then they told me they were going to ask me to leave if I didn't turn it around. And then in one of the stupid groups, I shared some things, which was a ton of shame that I was carrying around from my drinking and drugging. And this, like, weight was lifted. And I started to hear. I started to hear what they were saying. And significant things there is that people can come see you. You know, the only two people who came see me, it's pretty pathetic, is my alcohol counselor from my second drunk driving, which I was sentenced to, came and visited me, God bless his heart. And my parents. And when he came on visiting day, he came with the meaningless book, and he told me, I get out on a Saturday, he told me, I will take you to your very first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous when you hit the streets. You call me and I will take you. And I did just that. So I went through my 14 days. I heard some stuff. Now, I am the original Doubting Thomas, okay? I want proof. I think it's all rubbish. I think it's all rubbish. So I go to my first meeting, and God, do you not know? Okay, I'm in rehab, right? So every night you have, so this is all the thing. You have to hear AA meetings. They are the longest hour and a half of my life. I'm tapping the thing. I'm counting the tiles. I'm looking at the floor. I'm talking to the guy next to me. I'm like, oh, my God, with the Zen, it's been 5 minutes. I couldn't sit still, and I just didn't get how it worked. I thought, like, how am I ever going to learn anything from somebody standing here? I didn't get it. And so, but I knew some groups were particularly bad. They just particularly didn't hold my interest. And my first meeting on the street was one of those groups that had already heard of God's Knowledge. And I'm like, oh, my God, what luck is that? They're here again, and they were awful. And he said to me, Linda, he got me a meaningless book. And he said, he circled the meetings and told me that these are the ones every night of the week that I needed to go that he thought were good meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, kid, you're on your own. Now, nobody took me. He said, kid, you're on your own. I'm like, okay. So Sunday morning I get up and I go to the Sunday morning meeting. What's significant there, that's probably around January. I went in January 8th. I get out the 22nd. So it's around the end of January, 25th, somewhere around there. And I'm sitting in a meeting and I walk in and some guy says to me, you look new. And I'm like, what is it? Stiff on my head. I'm like, just leave me alone. And he's like, it's nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, God, these people just won't leave you alone. And he says, I think there's a woman I'd like you to meet. And I'm like, I don't think I'd like to meet her. And he said, come with me. And I'm like, in my head I have like this voice that says, I say one thing to your face that's very polite and kind, and I have this voice in my head that says, drop dead, leave me alone, just really nasty. But I don't really say them out loud, but I think them. And so he brings me over to meet this woman. I take one look at her and I know, we have nothing in common, and nor do I even want to speak to her. I very politely nod, say nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. He says, I think you should be your sponsor. And I said something like, I'll think about it, and I walk away. I go sit down, and the next most significant thing of that meeting, these are just like God things to me, is I see this guy get up and get his 18-year medallion. And I think, I don't remember one word that was said at that whole meeting, not one word. I remember meeting that woman. I remember the guy that came up to talk to me, they introduced me to that woman, and I remember this guy getting his 18-year medallion. So all I remember. That was my second meeting. My first meeting, all I remembered was the group that came in. I hated him when I saw him in Gosnold. I hated him even more the second time I saw him. All I remember. The guy gets his 18-year medallion, and I think, that's just rubbish. It's not even conceivable. I had, like, 18 days. I wanted another 8th. It was like the 26th. I had 18 days. January 8th, 1988 was my date. And I'm like, 18 years. I don't believe it. Got up. He got his cake. Got his medallion. Said a few words. He swept the floors. He put the chairs away. And I thought, And that's all I said. And I marched my little self out. And off I went. Next day, I get on the bus for work. Check this out, right? I get on the bus. Been taking the bus every day for a year now, right? Same bus, same place, same thing. Who's on that damn bus but that lady that they want to be my sponsor? I'm like, are you kidding me? Her name was Anne-Marie Matulis. I'll never forget her. She was the most important woman in my life. Everything I learned on how to keep a drink down was from Anne-Marie Matulis. Everything I learned was from Anne-Marie Matulis. Anne-Marie sat on that bus, and I looked at her, and I said, And now let me tell you, I'm quite unpleasant and quite disagreeable, so God bless Anne Marie. She probably didn't like me, and thank God you don't have to like who you sponsor. You just have to do it. And if it depended on people liking me, I would have been in big trouble. I said, how do you get a sponsor? Now, she was seriously plugged in. Seriously. She was an AA Nazi freak, AA all the way. AA was everything. It was in her blood. And she gave me the next day, and she gave me a great fine article about how to find a sponsor. I looked at the damn thing, and I said, my God, if I waited for that, I'll be drunk. And I said, will you do it? And she said yes. And that was the single greatest thing that ever happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I rode every day with her on a bus for an hour, and she read the big book with me. She was a big book thumper before it was good to be a big book thumper. And at one point, I think I could have recited that book verbatim. I don't know that I understood it, but we read it. And I fought about everything. I wanted to be terminally unique. Now, Anne Marie didn't, you know, where the AA I grew up in is they didn't mind offending you. I think they even liked offending you. They didn't mind hurting your feelings. They didn't mind telling you the truth whether you liked it or not. My sponsor didn't pull any punches. And quite sometimes she wasn't really, she was quite unpleasant. She was quite mean, I thought. And she gave me a list of things that I couldn't do. And my list was things like pretty basic. I couldn't go into a bar room to check on what Susie and Joe and Sam were doing. I couldn't shoot a game of pool because I felt like shooting a game of pool in a bar room. I couldn't go into a liquor store to buy cigarettes, scratch tickets, or a pack of gum. I had no reason to ever be in there ever again. She told me I couldn't drink NyQuil or vanilla. Didn't know people drank vanilla. Okay. And so I was like, what's up with NyQuil? She said, that's like 60% alcohol, whatever it is. So she told me I was never allowed to take NyQuil. She gave me this long list of do's and don'ts, of things that I was to do and not to do. And I adhered to methods. And that was easy for me. And I'm a coward. And so I joined her group because it was easier. And then I had a group. I had a sponsor. And I had a place to go where I felt I was at home. And I can remember, I don't know what I did, quite frankly. I think I cussed. I don't know what I did, but I did something from the podium that was completely unacceptable. And I could tell by the look on her face, I was in big trouble. This is how frightened I was. I left the meeting and thumbed home because I knew I was in big trouble. I don't know what I did. I thumbed home. They came looking for me. They're like, well, I'm like, I don't know, but I'm in big trouble. And she's so mad at me. And they're just like, Linda, that's ridiculous. But they did. I thumbed home from that meeting. She was really mad at me. And so I never did that. She told me how I was to behave in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was quite forthcoming about that. And I think that's good. I think that sometimes when I go to meetings and people are... I belonged to a group for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous back home, and we had, like, the halfway houses coming, and they didn't quite know how to behave, and they wanted to outlaw them, to call the halfway house and ask them not to come anymore because they were so disruptive. And I said, first, we're an open meeting. You can't do that. And secondly, that's just wrong. I think that we, as people with a little bit of time or old times, need to go up and teach these kids how to behave. And if you talk to somebody kindly and with respect, they almost always respond. We had a problem with noise because our church was in the neighborhood. I would go, guys, man, I know you don't want to come in from break, but you can't talk here because you see the windows are open, these families. And they were like, oh, man, we're sorry. We're, you know. But when you get mean with them, and so she would just tell me. And if you tell somebody nicely and not embarrass them, she didn't embarrass me in a room full of people. She took me aside quietly and said, this is not how we behave. I may not have liked it, but at least I knew where I stood. So inside of my journey of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she taught me things like never say no. She said, if Alcoholics Anonymous asks you, just could do it. You just never say no. And I was saying, please ask me if I... One of the things I know is Alcoholics Anonymous has never said no to me. If I've ever needed a meeting, I could always find a meeting. It's not closed because it's Christmas. It's not closed because it's New Year's. It's not closed because it's Halloween. There's Alcathons, you know, and holidays that run, where I come from, they run 48 hours, round the clock, and you can just go. So I understood that. She just didn't allow that. And so started my journey. We had things called step meetings up there where I was allowed to attend. I could read, but I was not allowed to open my mouth. I wasn't allowed to share anything. She told me that I didn't have anything to share, that I don't think I had anything of any value to say. That was another, like, depth, you know, deflation of ego at depth. I thought I was so smart, and I had plenty to share, and she told me I had nothing. And so begins my journey. And so I go to step meetings, and I hear things, and you might as well have been talking to me in Chinese. It didn't make any sense. I couldn't shit on it because I didn't understand it. You know, it didn't make any sense to me, but I went because she told me. So here I am, 5 months sober, I'm pregnant. 14 months sober, I'm delivering. 17 months sober, I'm drunk. But I'm going to meetings right along. Life is good, and I'm hearing things. I get my one-year medallion, and I think that's the most awesome thing in the world. And I'm talking to my sponsor, and in comes my daughter, Amanda, my baby girl, Amanda, and I'm full of fear. And my biggest character, I can't ask for help. One of the hardest things in Alcoholics Anonymous was going up to another human being, like sponsorship, and say, look, I'm 25, and I don't know what to do. I felt like such a loser. Everything was like such a loser. I'm 25, my life is a mess. Can you help me? I don't know how to fix it. And I can't, and I feel terrible. And I feel terrible that I have to ask you. And she said to me, you need to ask your parents for help. You're in over your head. And I was. And I couldn't. I just couldn't ask my parents for help. And I picked up a drink. Took 6 weeks, and I was done. And it's been, so my sobriety date is 8/8/1989. 6 weeks out of there, I had a black eye, torn cornea, fingerprints around my throat, a two-month-old baby, and the fear that somebody's going to take my child. And I come to enough Alcoholics Anonymous meetings to know that women lose their children every day. Men lose their children, but mothers lose their children every day because of alcohol and drug addiction. And I didn't want to lose my daughter. And what happens is my mother comes in one day. My mother decided she would take my daughter, my mom and dad would take my daughter every Thursday night. They did that for 15 years until my daughter didn't want to go. And they would take her, and my father, my father adores her. And it was a Thursday night. My daughter was sick. Amanda was sick. And she was an infant. She was like 3 months old. And my mother couldn't seem to get her comfortable. So she brought me home. And I had been out doing other things. And I was pasty white. And I'd been up for a couple days. And I didn't look very good. And she's like, what's wrong with you? Yeah, I'm fine. I'm okay, Mom. And I take my daughter. I put her to bed. I get her comfortable. And the guilt starts. And I'm lying in bed. And I'm wide awake. And my sponsor was all about the AA grapevine, so she gave me every tape on the planet. Man, I had more tapes, so I threw an AA tape in. Telling you, I never could find it again. But on the tape it said, if you don't like what you're doing, just stop it. And that, from that day forth, I stopped drinking and drugging. I hated the way I was living. I had a baby girl that I loved more than anything. I had a mother that was wondering what I was doing, you know, and my life was a mess again. So starts my second journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'm willing. I have no reservations that I belong here. You know, I was terminally unique when I first, my first 18 months around. You know, I try to argue everything. You know, it says in the doctor's opinion I'm mentally defective, and I found that offensive. I said, you know, my whole life I felt different. Now you're telling me I am different. And so I would say, do you really think I'm mentally defective? And they said, well, would you let somebody do to you what you've done to yourself? And I'm like, stewed on that for a while, and I do know that I'm mentally defective when it comes to booze and alcohol. When it comes to alcohol, I don't think like other people think. And so begins my journey in the steps now. You know, I'm still with Anne Marie, and step one, I'm powerless in that my life has become unmanageable. Yeah, I got a torn cornea, I've got a black eye, I've got fingerprints around my throat. I have a, what is it? What's about May, I guess? I started drinking in May, so it's about August. So my daughter's probably 6 months old, and I have a 6-month-old baby. Yeah, my life's unmanageable, you know. But I couldn't buy powerless. You know, do you know if you look up powerless in the dictionary, it says without power? That just didn't make any sense to me. You know what I mean? I'm like, okay, that didn't help me any. And this is how I do Alcoholics Anonymous. If I don't understand it, I just let it go. I don't fight with it anymore. Because my sponsor used to say, put it on a Rolodex, and it'll flip up at the appropriate time, and the light will go off, and it'll just stop struggling, Linda. Stop struggling. So I would flip things. There were lots of things I didn't understand. You know, I would just file it away, and I would wait for the moment that the light would come on, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm in powerless, aren't I? I can't guarantee what the outcome of the night's going to be when I pick up a drink. Can't tell you whether I'm going to have a black eye. Can't tell you whether I'm going to whip a beer bottle at you. Can't tell you if I'm going to get arrested for drunk driving. So, yeah, but that took a long time, and so I just let that go because I hung on to my life's unmanageable, and I don't like it. I don't like who I am. I don't like what I've become. So, comes step two, they start to tell me that I'm insane. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Please, I hold a good job, I'm really responsible, blah, blah, blah. I didn't understand the insanity piece, but I get today that when it comes to alcohol, I can't seem to recall that it gets me into trouble and I pick up a drink anyway, that I have no memory of what happens when I drink. And I allow the insanity, and it's the insanity of drink, don't drink. Drink, don't drink. I don't think other people have that dialogue going on in their heads that I have. So I understood that late, but I kind of skipped over step two. Step three, I wish somebody explained I struggled with that. Nobody ever told me it was just a decision. You know, up north where I came in 1989, they just said, turn your life over. And I'm like, what am I turning over? But this is what I did know. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous work. So I turned my life and my will over to the care of my sponsor and Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life got better. And that was my higher power for many years. I came in with a deep-seated, deep-rooted spiritual prejudice. It was very hard for me to get the God concept. But I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous worked. Now, I told you I was the original Downing Thomas, and the way I know Alcoholics Anonymous worked is that early on in my sobriety, I heard the bartender of the bar I drank at speak. Now, he was worse than I was. I mean, I saw him getting arrested. He drank behind the bar. He was fist fighting behind the bar. It was bad. We were both bad, and I knew how he behaved. And I heard him speak at a meeting, and he was articulate, and he was soft-spoken, and his life was going places. And I fundamentally knew there was a change in his soul and his heart. I knew that. And so when you got up and spoke, what do I know? You could be saying anything. You know, I don't know how you live. And so when I heard him speak, I fundamentally knew that Alcoholics Anonymous worked. And so I said, sitting in that meeting that night, if it can work for him, it can work for me. And that's when I knew Alcoholics Anonymous would work. And so step three was really difficult. But that's how I did step three. I turned my life and my will over to the care of Alcoholics Anonymous and my sponsor, and my life got better. My fourth step, back home, you know, I didn't think I had any character defects. You know, I went to the Clancy thing. They were making fun of. I had every, you know, blueprints for progress. I had all of the notebooks and the workbooks on how to do a four step. I didn't understand a character defect. False pride. You could explain to me till you blew in the face. I couldn't get it. I just didn't understand it. Didn't get it. So my first four step I thought was an eighth step until I heard Allison say, you know, they have the sex conduct, but at that group they call it just a conduct inventory. And my conduct just was abominable. I had hurt so many people and done so many things that my first four step was like an eighth step. I just wrote everything I had hurt or harmed, because that's what was bubbling inside me. That's what was sitting on the surface, is all the people I had hurt and all the disappointing things I had done and all the shame I carried inside me. All that shame. So I my eighth step was done. So my fourth step was done. That was the best I could do. I didn't believe in doing it with a sponsor. I didn't trust many people. We had priests up north that were in recovery. I did it with a recovering priest. Never saw it again. It was perfect. And I kept that one thing that I told you that happened at my mom's house. And I was struggling with sponsorship for a while. And I got this sponsor in Boston, and I let it go with her. I never saw her again either. I let it go with her, and she said to me, "Damn, Lynette, if that's the worst thing you have done in your life, you are all set." And I was like, oh my God, really? And it was such a deep-rooted shame. Such a deep-rooted shame. And it revolved around a man that I really cared about. And I hadn't seen him since that incident at my mother's house. And since I had my fourth step. And now I have 2 years sobriety. And I run into him. And I see him, he sees me, and I run out the door. He follows me out, and I am mortified. And I'm like, I can't even look at you. He's like, why? I'm like, that whole, and he's like, it's over. I'm like, yeah, you know, look, I'm really sorry. I've been sober a couple. He's like, where have you been? I'm like, I've been sober a couple years. He's like, really? He's like, you look different. You look great. There is something. And so we started to chat, and he tried to get this program. And he put about 6 months together, and we were hanging out, and he was real special. His name is Peter. And Peter had been married, and him and his wife had been drinking buddies for years. They had 4 children, and they were separated, and they were in there. You had to wait 6 months, and it was like the day that they were supposed to, you know, the six-month day they go back to court and sign it, they decided to reconcile, and he picked up a drink. And I love that man. God, he was such a good man. And he came to my house to say goodbye, and he was drunk, and I gave him a kiss, and I told him he was going to die. And he died a month later. I think he killed himself. We all think he killed himself in a motorcycle accident. He pulled out. And they called me, and he was living with somebody I knew, and I said to the girl, He was living with a guy, and I knew the girl, the other guy's girlfriend. I said, when Peter dies, will you call? And she called me. And she said, Peter was in a bike accident in front of the house, and it's bad. And I called the hospital, and the nurse said Peter should live. His injuries were really bad, but Pete should make it. His wife was in far worse shape than he. There must have been 40 people at the hospital, I swear to God. He was such a loved man, and he had four kids, little kids. And it was a sunny, sunny, warm day. And it was like 6 o'clock at night. And there was the family room, which we couldn't go in. And the windows were open. And we were standing outside talking. And I hear this most god-awful scream. And it was one of the kids. And they came in to say that he had died. And I slid down the wall. And I said, there is nobody that's going to tell my daughter that I died because I was drunk. And got killed in a car accident. It was the most horrific scream. And it stayed with me forever. And I thought, that poor child. You know, and that's alcoholism. It takes the people we love, and it broke my heart. And the lies. I went to his funeral, and he had been drinking with his wife, and they had gotten home safely, and she wanted to go out for one more, or whatever. That's what she wanted. They wanted to go out for one more. I shouldn't say she did. And he was too drunk to stand. He got on his bike, and he pulled out in front and got killed. And I'm sitting at the funeral, and they're talking about that they were going to get ice cream. And I'm like, they've never gotten ice cream a day in their life. You know what I mean? The big lie. Alcoholism. The big lie. They were out to get ice cream. They were absolutely legless. Her injuries were catastrophic. So that was a big turning point for me. I really delved into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was part of a group. I've always been part of a group. I've always had a sponsor. I've always worked the steps. What's my life like today? So my life takes off and it gets better. I raise my daughter in Alcoholics Anonymous. I live in Massachusetts and I buy a home on my own. You know, my daughter grows up. We live in a stable environment. I have solid, solid AA friends that I've been sober with for 20 years. They've been sober for 20 or more years. We've been running together for 20 years. They come to my home. My kid's grown up in sobriety, grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. She was always running around. I know it's not... You don't see them here, but up north, they're running around, and everybody was good with that, and life is okay, and my house is an open door, it's a revolving door. Anybody that wants to get sober or trying to get sober, comes through my door. And my daughter's seen me busting needles off things, taking people to detoxes, you know, getting rid of all of it. She's seen it all, you know, and we're taking people to detox, people are crashing one night, and life is good, you know, I mean... I like that. I love that people came to my home. I'd get home and there'd be notes. I never locked my door. There'd be notes on my door. Needed to talk to you. You weren't here. Played with the dog. Catch up with you later. Or, you know, one guy's like, I was working up the street. Came to see if you were here. Saw the cookies on the table. Ate 6 of them. Left. You know, people would come in and out of my home. And I liked it. That's how I liked it. And I did a lot of kitchen AA in my home. And my life was good. My kids got this god-awful disease. And it just about took her life. And she lived on the streets for a couple of years at the age of 16. Between 16 and 17, I was not a model AA person. I let my sponsees go, and I said, look, I am just so consumed with this. My daughter is walking down the street, eating at soup kitchens, and it's not because she's not loved. It's because she's got this goddamn disease that's killing her, and I just am so empty. I can barely go to work. I can barely go to meetings. And I am so dead inside, and I am so tortured, and I can't sleep, and I cry all the time, and I worry, and I was on the first name, you know, she was either being arrested or she was overdosing. It was just horrific. Cops, if I hadn't heard from my daughter, I could call a policeman and say, Officer LaGrace, Amanda's been missing for 3 weeks, and he'd say, I've seen Amanda. She's safe. Well, she's not safe, but she's alive. I'd be, okay, Officer LaGrace, that's pretty pathetic. And so... That was a really difficult time in my sobriety. My life has been really good, and I was really good up until that run with my daughter. But I managed to stay sober. I went to meetings. I talked to my sponsor. I was probably pretty bankrupt. I didn't have a whole lot to give. It took all I could do to sit in a seat, sit still, listen, not drink, and go to work. That's all I could do. You know, I know people take lots of people's inventories. I just know that I did the best I could, you know. My kid was dying, and I was dying every day with her. I think I was dying more than she was dying. So, how I end up in Virginia. My kid's dying, living on the streets. And I say, I can't drive by her. I go to work at the soup kitchen.
we're getting people sober at the soup kitchen, and I can't get my kids sober. Horrible. And it's awful. So I decide that if I come here, she'll come here too. And maybe she'll have a chance. I didn't have much going on in my life. I mean, I had my family and my friends, but I didn't have a guy, and I didn't have kids, and it was just me, and I was pretty well off. And so, you know, I decided that I'm going to sell it all, and I'm moving here. I'm going to give my kid a chance. I sold it all. Happened real fast. I sold my house for a tremendous value just before it crashed. I didn't think, you know, it was just God, because I didn't think it was going to work out. But everything happened lickety-split, and when I wanted to change my mind, I couldn't. And so here I am coming to Virginia. Amanda's not coming. I'm coming alone, and I'm terrified. I'm beyond terrified. I'm all alone. You know, my kid's dying, I'm dying, and I'm coming to a strange place. But I do what I always do. I roll into town, and I roll into AA. I sit at AA meetings around the clock, because I'm terrified. My daughter rolls into town 3 months later. She puts down her drug of choice, finally. She lives indoors. She's been living indoors for the last couple of years. I know you don't think that's much of an accomplishment, but it's a huge accomplishment that my kid lives indoors. She doesn't eat in soup kitchens anymore. She'll give the last dollar she has to the last addict and homeless man on the street. And she should be here. But she's at least put down her drug of choice and she can function. And she's finally employable, and she's finally got her own place, and she's living on her own. And I have peace today. I can shut my phone off at night. I can sleep. I can be a reasonable member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous got me through that. You know, when I was coming around, these old timers would bang on the damn podium and they would say, Alcoholics Anonymous only promises you one day of sobriety. And I would be like, ooh, woo-hoo, who cares about that? And what I did, what they didn't say to me was things like, but it gives you so much, for me, it gives you so much more than that. It gives me opportunities that I didn't think I would ever have. It makes me available to things that I was never available for. You know, it changes my perspective. And what I learned is, I was about 13 years sober, and I was at a friend's house, and they had this plaque on the wall, and it said, change your thoughts and change your world. And I thought, oh my God, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what people do at the podium. They completely changed the way I thought, and you guys have completely changed my world. But I didn't know that. When I was sitting here thinking back in the day and I was in rehab and people were at the podium, I'm like, what am I going to learn from that person at the podium? But you guys totally changed the way I thought. You told me things like, alcohol is not a beverage. It's a poison. You might as well feed me arsenic. And I took it out of the beverage, column, and I put him in the poison column. You know, my sponsor said things like, because I was talking in half sentences, which really baffled me. You can't dry off with a wet towel. That. And I was way too proud to ask. You know, I have this big character flaw, this belief that I should know everything. And I don't know where I picked that up, but for some reason I always thought I should know everything, and I never want to appear stupid. So if I don't know, I'm much better. I will ask, but I will listen and I won't comment, and I'll either research it later or I'll listen to what people say, but I never wanted you to know that I didn't know because I didn't want you to think I was stupid. And I'd be like, don't try, you can't try. And Jesus was telling me, two people that are in this early sobriety can't get sober together. You got to hang out with people with time. And I was probably 15 years sober and two kids from a detox. I mean, a rehab center or whatever. They were in a halfway house together. Have a pass. They were doing a legitimate thing. They jump on the train, do this legitimate errand. The kid looks at the other kid and says, I want to get high today. Not one of them said, geez, we should call our sponsor. Maybe we should go to a meeting. Maybe we should do this. Maybe we should go back to the halfway house. Big old carpet bag of dope, and the kid overdoses. Two wet towels. You can't dry off with a wet towel. And you know, if you call me and you want to drink, I can almost guarantee you that I'm not going to say to you, "Come on, let's go." I'm probably going to say, "Let's get a cup of coffee, come to my house." You know, let's see if we can't talk this through. I'm also going to tell you to eat something sweet. My sponsor said, if you want, you know, I did the ice cream and the candy dye in the beginning. Sweets kill the desire for alcohol. That worked for me. I did that. She told me that I was going to learn how to teach people how to treat me. That's a tough one. It took me like 10 years to learn what that meant. And she was right. By doing the steps, I know who I am and what I am today. And I had no idea. And I know what how I will allow someone to treat me today in my life and what I will accept and what I won't accept. And I didn't know that when I got here. I didn't know that at all. I know that when I got here, I compromised all of my principles. And by the time I finished, I had no principles.
And me and my husband were just talking, and I was having a problem at my job, and I was talking to my sponsor about it. And they wanted to compromise. They wanted me to compromise who I was. And they wanted me to be less than who I wanted me to be. And I said to my husband, I can't work there anymore. I can't be less than who I am. My whole life, I have compromised who I am. I am not willing to do that today. I am who I am. And I don't want to be less than who I am. I certainly probably could be better than who I am. But I don't want to be less than who I am. And I don't let people compromise. I don't compromise myself today like I used to. I try not to, you know. And that's important to me. And it took me a long time to draw those lines in the sand about how I wanted to be treated. And I learned that through the steps. And I learned that here. And my life's amazing. So I come to Virginia and I'm a mess. And I'm, you know, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1988, and I think, like, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to drink at my wedding. And I realize I don't get married ever until I'm in my 21st year of sobriety. I come here and I meet my husband, a good old southern, you know, country boy, and he's married a damn Yankee. And we have a good life today. I love my husband. He's such a good man. We're both in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought that would happen. I had given up on the fact that I was ever going to meet anybody to get married to. Never been married in my life. And we just celebrated 1 year yesterday. And that's pretty cool. You know, life is good. And my daughter Liz went back up north. She chose to go back up north. And she's doing okay. I miss her terribly. And she misses me. And, but her life is much better today. And I don't think she's going to die. She said to me, she's actually thinking about coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. She's been to many meetings and she said she wanted to go. She's had some horror shows of her own recently with alcohol. And, she said that when she comes, she feels better. Imagine. And, you know, another important thing is my daughter has all of the knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous. She has no application. She will sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was with her and a friend, and she heard something, and the boy said this is what they said. And she said, Mom, that's not what they said. This is what they said, and this is what they meant. Huh, Mom? And I'm like, absolutely, honey. But she doesn't know how to apply it in her life. But she has all the knowledge, but no application. And when knowledge is not going to get me sober, I have to apply it. And that's another thing my sponsor said. Kid, you don't have to like it, you just got to do it. I don't care that you don't like it, I just want you to do it. Whatever I tell you to do, I want you to do. She used to say, from my lips to your ears is a command. It's not a suggestion. That's what she told me. And I did that for a long, long, long time. And I'm grateful. My life is really, really good. I have a home, I have a job that I really like, I have a husband that I love, I have a daughter that I adore, and I have parents that adore me that I adore. You know, my dad's sick. I'm going to be the daughter that I want to be with my dad. I'll go home and take care of my dad. You know, I help my mom with my dad, and I imagine I'll have to return home at some point, and that's okay. And I don't know, if you're new and if you're struggling, you're sitting here today, there is hope. There's more than hope. There's a whole new life out there that you can't even begin to imagine. If I had sat down and wrote what I wanted or what I thought my life would be, it would probably have been stupid things like material things. But I have peace today. I can't even begin to tell you what that means. I had no peace. My mother would tell you the first year of my sobriety, I paced like a wild animal. She could see my agitation. She could feel it in every part of my being when I first got sober. We would go to a family event and she would have to leave. I was so uncomfortable, I would make her uncomfortable. That's how uncomfortable I would be. She could feel. And she looked at my daughter at Thanksgiving and she said, about my second year in sobriety, she said to me, I don't know who that girl was, but my daughter's back. You know, and that was huge. And then she said to my daughter, we were having this discussion. My daughter's life was, of course, out of control. And she said, you know, your mom is quite a lady. She wasn't the lady she was when she drank, but Alcoholics Anonymous has made her into somebody that's unbelievable. And she had tears in her eyes. I don't know if that's true, but she thinks it's true, so that's all that matters. And I suppose coming from where I started, I might be a little bit unbelievable. And it's just nice to know that my mom sees the difference in who I am today. And for that, I am grateful. Thanks.